part. Matthew chapter 16, look at verse 1. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came, testing him and saying, asked him that he would show them a sign from the heaven. If you've been with us in our study of the Gospel of John, they have had signs up to here. Voices from heaven, John the Baptist, the last Old Testament prophets. And look what they're saying. Hey, you got another sign? Verse 2. And he, Jesus, answered and said to them, when it is evening and you say, it will be fair weather because the sky is red. And then in the morning, it will be foul weather today because the sky is red and threatening. You guys remember that one? Red sky at night is a sailor's, and red sky in the morning, sailor take. Well, there it is. See, it was back even here in the Bible. You know how to discern the face of the sky, the red sky at night thing, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. Would you circle that, please? Signs of the time. Now, in this instance, this is Messiah standing right in front of them. These Palestinian protests are unsettling. The events in Gaza are unsettling. How should we think? May the shepherd this morning help us get an idea. Are you ready? We have 114 slides, and I'm not joking. We got 114 of them. Let's go and get started. Are you ready, Rick? Start the stopwatch. Go. Pro-Palestinian protests are happening in our universities in 45 out of 50 states. Encampments in 140 campuses, and many faculty are joining in. And that's Harvard. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Now notice the words and the signs accusing Israel of colonialism, apartheid. Most people don't even know what those means. Colonialism is a stronger nation subjugating a weaker nation and saying this is how we're going to do it. What is apartheid? Apartheid is the unfair separation simply because of your skin or your where you come from. Now we're all pretty familiar with the term genocide. If you notice this, from the river to the sea is on most of those signs. Do you know what that means? From the river to the sea? Well, here's Israel today, and you'll see those modern designations, Egypt and Jordan, Syria and Lebanon, and then you see the West Bank. It's called the West Bank because it's the west bank of the Jordan River, and then the little strip where all this stuff is happening is Gaza. What do you mean, the river from the sea? Here's what they mean. The Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. They're calling for the extinction of the Jewish people. I got to show you why. Who does this land actually belong to? It belongs to Abraham. In 2000 BC, in Genesis 15, verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land. Now, if you didn't know, Abraham has a son, Isaac, but there was another son, his name was Ishmael, that remember, God said to very old Abraham and Sarah, you're going to have a child, and they're like, really? Sarah has an idea, well, I can't have kids, so what about you go into my handmaiden, Hagar, and then that son will be the son of this promise. Is that the son of God's promise? No, that's Ishmael. Who is the legitimate son and heir to this promise? Is it Ishmael or is it Isaac? It is Isaac. Who is Ishmael? He will go on and found 12 tribes also. And those 12 tribes of Ishmael are what the Arabs are today. Is everybody okay with that? Arab nation traces itself back to 12 princes or 12 tribes of Ishmael. Now, to Isaac, he says in Genesis 26, verse 3, not Ishmael, who are the Arabs, but to Isaac. He says, I give all these lands and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father. Who's Isaac's son? Jacob. Does God reiterate the promise? Yes. Genesis 28, verse 33, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. And the land on which you lie, he's lying in this region right now, or he was at that moment, I will give to you and your descendants. Does it stop there? It's almost like God would have us know exactly who the land belongs to. Go ahead. What about Moses? 1400 BC, Numbers 27, verse 12. The Lord said to Moses, go up unto this mountain, Mount Abram, and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. Who comes after Moses? Joshua. What does God say to him? Joshua 1 verse 3, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you as I said to Moses. Who does the land belong to? The descendants of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, etc. Are we pretty clear on that one? If you don't believe that the Bible is the authoritative word of God, well, that's a whole nother issue. But it is very clear that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob says, this is the land I've given you. Now, what happens is, in 1400 BC, they come in under Joshua. God promised the land to Abraham. So Abraham leaves out of Ur of the Chaldees, and he settles in the land. He has Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then what happens is Jacob has 12 sons, which become the 12 tribes of Israel. But then remember, the 12 sons, they take son number 11, Joseph, and they throw him in a pit. He says, we should kill you. We're really jealous. Let's don't kill him. Let's sell him. They sold him to guys going to Egypt. And then there, Joseph prospered. 400 years later, now there are a couple million Jewish people in Egypt. Pharaoh is making their life very, very difficult. They cry out for a deliverer. God sends them Moses. Out of Egypt they come, and then they come to the promised land. Why is it called the promised land? Because it was promised through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and Joshua. And while the 400 years that they were gone, God prophesied it would be four generations. When they come back, then the usurpers had come into God's promised land called the Canaanites. The Amorites and the Hittites and the Cellulites and all the other lights there all collectively are known as the Canaanites. Well, Joshua then has to lead a seven-year campaign. All the usurpers are driven out. And then from that moment, really until 70 AD, there was a 70-year exile, 600 BC, but then they come back after that. So really, from Moses and Joshua to 70 AD, there was Israel in the land of Israel. Does that make logical sense? All right. Your kings, your chronicles, and all the history books, that really happened. What happens in 70 AD? The Romans destroy Jerusalem, and they destroy the temple, and they kill most of the Jews that are there. Many leave, but some stayed. That is a depiction of the temple. And to the left of the screen, the black smoke, that's the temple on fire. You see people falling. That is from the altar of Herod's temple at the time. That's what this depicts. So most of the Jews flee Israel, but there is a very small, that fleeing out, by the way, is called the diaspora. The Romans, they take over everything. They kill over 1 million Jewish people. And then something fascinating happens. This guy's name is Simon Bar Kokhba, and he leads a revolt. He proclaims himself as the promised Messiah, and many people come back to Israel. And he militarizes a guerrilla warfare, ground warfare tactic, and he actually ousts the 10th Legion out of Jerusalem. And for about 2 years, they're like, we're in zoning control again. The good news is they kicked out the Romans. The bad news is they kicked out the Romans. Because then the next guy, his name is Emperor Hadrian. He says, oh, no, they didn't. And he sends massive troops. They hunt down and they kill Bar Kokhba. And they end the revolt. And Hadrian is so angry with these Jews, thinking they're all that. What he does? He defeats Bar Kokhba. He outlaws Jews in Jerusalem. If you are a Jewish person in Jerusalem and you pray or they catch you, you are dead. Everybody chases everybody out of Jerusalem. He changes Jerusalem, the name Jerusalem, to Aelia Capitolina. and he builds a temple on the Temple Mount to Jupiter. How many of you didn't know that happened? He did. Here's a picture of it. And that's pretty accurate to scale. Why do we know so much about this temple to Jupiter? He built this on the Temple Mount because he built another one at the same time in Lebanon. And it still remains. Look at that. Those are ruins to the temple to Jupiter that Hadrian built the same time he built one in Jerusalem. Anyway, back to our story. So what happens is he named the region Syria Palestina. Now, this is about 135, actually. 135, 136 AD. He changes the name. Let's get rid of the name Israel that had been there for almost 20, what would that be, the math on that, 2100 years thereabouts. And he changes the name. Let's call it Palestina. Why? Because it was named after Israel's hated enemy, the Philistines. That's where the name comes from. Okay, let's keep cruising. Go. By the way, Philistine is a Hebrew word. That's probably not what they called themselves, but the Hebrews called them Philistines. Why? Because it's the Hebrew word for marauder. They settled in southern Israel on the coastlands, Gaza. In fact, in the Bible, you will see the name Gaza, roughly around 1200 BC. They were from the Aegean Sea. They were from Greece. They were European. They were not from Ishmael, and they were not Arab, were the Philistines. Well, what happens to them? Then in 604 BC, before Jesus, did you know that the Babylonians who did destroy the temple, Solomon's temple there in Jerusalem, they kept going. And they destroyed all the Babylonian cities and scattered the survivors. So by and large, Philistines are no more. This is crucial. The current Palestinians have no genetic link to the biblical Philistines. Philistines in the Bible were European. The Palestinians of today are of Arab descent. Well, then what happens? Well, see, Roman has a hard time. They reach their zenith about a little after 100 AD, thereabouts, and then all of this stuff happens. The Anglo-Saxons, the Franks, the Goths, the Visigoths, everybody from Fernley, they jumped right in there, and then they pretty much wiped out the Roman Empire as we know it. But a big portion of the Roman Empire thrives in the east. They are called the Byzantines. Go ahead. So about 500 AD or so, Rome as we know it is overrun. I won't go into all of the specifics, but I want to draw our attention to this region of the world that we're looking at. 500 to 700 AD, the Byzantines, which are Christian Europeans, control the region of what is today Israel. The name Jerusalem returns. Remember, Hadrian changed it to Aulia Capitolina. Let's call it Jerusalem again, and then the region still sort of has the name of Palestine. Then in 70 to 190, 1095, then the Muslim Turks are in control of the region now. They were quite a band of warriors and so on, so then they rush and they take advantage, and then they take control of the region. Well, then the Europeans go, you can't do that. So back and forth, pretty much from 1095 to 1299, there's your Crusades, where the Europeans and the Arabs and the Muslims are fighting it back and forth. Well, pretty soon, by the time you get to 1299, you have a very strong Turkish, Seljuk Turkish, and you get this. Go ahead. Now you're going to have, that's your Ottoman Turkish Empire. And it was quite an empire indeed, and a lot of wonderful stuff happened through the region, but the Ottoman Empire was in control of the region that we're talking about today from roughly 1299 to 1922. Why do you suppose they had to relinquish their land in 1922? Because of the First World War. The Ottoman Turks, they backed the wrong horse. And so the Axis countries were defeated. Go ahead, but this is important. I want you to see this. From 1299 to 1922, this is what the region looked like. Let's zoom in. Go ahead. There's the region. Do you see the word Palestine anywhere on this map? No, because for 800 years, this entire region was not known as Palestina or Palestine. Please see this graphic firmly. 800 years, nobody called this region Palestine. Are you with me? They called it all of those names. There has never been a nation called Palestine. You need to know that. Now I'm going to get you this guy. You might recognize him. That's my Uncle Albert. No, it's not my Uncle Albert. This, of course, is Mark Twain. Did you know that he traveled to this region in 1867, a little before that? He wrote about it. He traveled through Jerusalem. Look at what he said when he was there in the year 1867. He said, "We traversed through miles of desolate country whose soil is given over wholly to weeds. It is a silent and mournful expanse," he's speaking of Jerusalem. "A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We never saw a human on the whole route. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere." By the way, that's because the Arabs, for a long time, taxed you on how many trees you had. Because if you had trees, you're probably rich and getting stuff off it, like fruit and olives and stuff, so we're going to tax you. So you know what most, for hundreds of years, they did in the Ottoman Turkish Empire for this whole region? They cut down all the trees. They did. And because they did that, they actually stopped and altered the water cycle. And the latter rains no more. So there was only olive and cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil. Even these seemed desperate to desert this deserted land. When he got there in the middle 1800s, there was hardly a thing. In fact, here's a picture of Jerusalem in 1940. The Egyptians controlled what is today the Gaza Strip to the south. The British overseed the whole thing. And this is Jerusalem in 1940. Please get a good look at that. There's what it looked like in 1940. Do you see much commerce and infrastructure in this region? You don't. There is the Dome of the Rock. What happens after World War I is British and the French, they divide the entire region. The nation of Israel that we know today was under what's called the British Mandate, and then up north where currently Lebanon, that was the French Mandate. This is all after World War I. And here's what else they did. The British used the word in 1918, Palestine, for the first time in 800 years. Why did they do that? That's because they had to redraw the entire region. These are the nations that we know in this region today. Before World War I, it didn't look like that always. They came up with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon. Transjordan is what it was called, not Israel, and even Turkey. These are the new nations since World War I. From AD 70 to 1948, there has never been a nation or a people called Palestine. Does everybody see that? Well, then where did the Palestinians come from? I'll show you. All right. In 1948, the British Mandate ends. What's going to happen to the Jewish people? Well, we just learned that Hitler had killed systematically 6 million of them. There was a window of opportunity and sympathy throughout the whole world. And in 1948, the United Nations, the gavel falls, and in one day, Israel becomes a nation. When they took over the glorious land, that's what it looked like in 1948. And because of their industry and hard work, this is Jerusalem today. This is Beersheba before, Beersheba now. This is Eilat down by the Red Sea before, up there, and there's what it looks like today. This is what Tel Aviv looked like before 1948. And this is what Tel Aviv looks like today. The Arab culture had 800 years to apply their industry or focus on the region. I showed you those old pictures because they couldn't care less about that region until the Jews had control of it. Please hear that. That's a very important understanding. So where did the modern Palestinians come from? This is a map in 1948 when the United Nations says Israel will become a nation. They put forth a peace plan, and in that peace plan, they purposed that they could have a two-state. You could have Israel and Palestine. The leaders of the Arabs at that time rejected it, and they say, we will not have it. And so what happens is they went to war. These two circles here, that's the Gaza Strip to the south, and then Arabs in the West Bank. Now, please notice I have underlined the word Arabs. They were not Palestinians. They were not known as Palestinians, not for 800 years. No nation, no people. They were Arab peoples whose ethnicity goes back to the Ottoman Empire. There were Arabs in Gaza, and then there were Arabs in the West Bank. And so when the Arab leaders said, you better get out of the way because we're going to push Israel right into the sea in 1948, those Arabs in Gaza and those Arabs in the West Bank said, okay. And so they got out of the way, many of them. What happened was the Arabs did not win the war, and the Israelis, the Jewish people, they then had the land. They won that war. They repulsed all those nations coming against them. What happened to the Gazan Arabs and the West Bank Arabs? Israel said, you can live where you've always lived. You can have your work and your business, but you have to recognize that you now live in the land of Israel. And they said, never! Okay. And then what began is a system of camps. And here is an indication of where many of those camps are. Now here in Gaza to the south, you'll notice that there was a high concentration of refugee camps. Why were they refugee camps? This is very important. They said, you can become a functioning citizen of Israel. They said, no. Then the world said, hey, Arab nations, why don't you absorb all of those refugees? And all of the Arab nations, and Egypt is not Arab, but even they're Islamic. Every one of those nations said what about taking hundreds of thousands of refugees? No. So then what happened is Israel, some Arab nations, and the United Nations, they began to build these camps, trying to wait for some kind of solution. And fortunately, there was not a great place to live for many. There are many of those camps. Some of them were difficult. These are the refugee camps. And this is where these Arab peoples began to find a sense of identity. And the identity that they were rallying around was, we are a poor and oppressed people. You please have to understand this. Billions of dollars flowed into this region, trying to help them find and found any kind of semblance of society. In some places, it did look a little bit better. This is Nablus. This is in the West Bank. This is also Shechem. But this is Nablus. This is Arab. These are the Palestinians of this region. Here's the center square of Nablus. It's a bustling place. By the way, before October 7th, if you were to walk in this region and you would wear a t-shirt, go Jewish people and yay Israel, what would happen to you? You would be probably violated, violenced, or thrown off of a building. True story. In fact, there are signs all around. If you are entering into Nablus, there are signs that are placed there by the IDF, Israeli Defensive Force. We cannot guarantee your safety if you go past this. Israel stays, by and large, out of Nablus because of all the challenges that happen. What about Gaza? Well, in Gaza, there was a strong contingency, many people, and by the time you get to 2004, Gaza and Gaza City was a bustling place. Gaza, as a rule, does not have much agriculture. It does not generate its own power. It has very little industry. Billions have poured into Gaza trying to make a semblance of civilization. And when something happened in the year 2005, what happened in 2005? Let's go back to 1948. 1948, Egypt was in control of Gaza. After Egypt was soundly defeated in the War of Independence, 1948, they say, you take care of it. And Israel did. And in 2004, Israel was in charge, but something was happening. That whole Palestinian movement was gaining force. And in the year 2005, the United States under Walker or W. Bush and the United Nations and European Union put tremendous pressure on Ariel Sharon in 2005, disengaged from Gaza. And Ariel Sharon said, are you crazy? The moment we stop weapons flowing in from the sea, that's the Mediterranean Sea to the top left, they're going to start lobbing rockets into southern Israel. And the response was, no, they won't. They promised they would not. 2005, Israel disengages. In 2006, they elect Hamas. And since 2006, there has not been another election. 2004, Gaza and Gaza City was a pretty pleasant place. You know what it looks like now. Did you know that the Bible predicted the Arab-Israeli conflict in 2000 in BC? Did you know that? When God has to part with his illegitimate son Ishmael, in Genesis 16, verse 12, God says that Ishmael's descendants, the Arabs, will be, quote, against every man and every man against him. And he, the Arabs, will strive against the descendants of Isaac. That was 2000 BC. Is it happening today? Absolutely. In 1947, when the British mandate is coming up on being done, what are we going to do? The United Nations and everybody else says, we'll do a two-state solution. And there it is. That's the plan. In 1947, UN Israel-Palestine partition plan, but it was rejected. By who? By this guy. This guy is Hassan Pasha. He is the first Secretary General of the Arab League. Who are the Arab League? These are people who hate Israel. And they say, no way, no Israel. It's either no Israel or no us. And so they refused. They refused, and as a result, in 1948, that was the first Arab-Israeli war that Israel wins on March 10th, 1949. Other Arab-Israeli peace plans rejected by the Palestinians. Did you know that the world has been trying to get the Palestinians, the whole notion of them identifying as Palestinians comes since World War II was over and 1948. Does everybody see that? In front of 1948, there were no, what we would consider Palestinians, and there never has been a nation or a people. But after 1948, when they had to move out of the way of their Arab brothers who lost that war, that group of people, especially Gaza and the West Bank, they said, well, where are we supposed to go now? Israel says, stay where you've always lived. Only recognize that you are living in the land of Israel. And those people said, no, the camps form. And then they begin to murmur. What a lousy lot that we have. Well, why don't you go back to live with your Arab nations? No, because none of the Arab, really Islamic nations would let them in. They loved the PR of all the awful sort of camp circumstances, and they used that as propaganda against the Israelis. Why? Because they want the Israelis out of the land that God promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and Joshua. That's why. Well, anyway, it's not since World War II, really, that they begin to identify as we are Palestinians. Other Arab-Israeli plans rejected by the Palestinians are, and we'll go quickly. This is the Lausanne Conference in 1949. Let's give you guys a state. It was scuttled by the Palestinians. And then the Camp David Accord, 1978, there's Jimmy Carter, Menachem Begin, who was from Israel, and that's Anwar Sadat from Egypt. He dared reach a hand across to Israel and got assassinated for his problems, for his trouble. Anyway, that was also rejected by the Palestinians. Then you have the Madrid Conference in 1991. I don't have time to go around the room, but there is Herbert Walker Bush up there in Spain, scuttled by the Palestinians. Then Oslo Accords, 1993 and 1995, there's Yasser Arafat. Who is he? He is huge. He founded the Palestinian Liberation Organization. More on him in a moment. That is President Jefferson Clinton and then the Israeli Prime Minister at the time. That was in Norway. Happened twice. Both of those were scuttled by Arafat. No! No! These are the Hebron Protocol. There is Yasser Arafat and there is Benjamin Netanyahu. In 1976, a Jewish aircraft was hijacked by PLO terrorists and taken to Entebbe, which is in Uganda. They threatened to kill every one of the Jews on that plane that was hijacked, and Israel sent in some highly professional Mossad and agents, and a startling raid called the Raid of Entebbe, you might recall. They were rescued in a dramatic fashion. Only one Jewish soldier was killed in that raid in Entebbe. His last name was Netanyahu. It was Benjamin Netanyahu's brother who was killed in the raid of Entebbe, 1976, ordered by Yasser Arafat. There is Benjamin Netanyahu standing up at a table in 1997 in Hebron, shaking hands with the man who resulted, whose work resulted in the death of his own brother. Please understand how this works. What else did they reject? The Y River Memorandum, 1998. There's Yasser Arafat, again Netanyahu. Again in the Sharm el-Sheikha Memorandum, 1999 in Egypt. There's Arafat again. Also, the Camp David Summit in 2000. These are every time that the world tried to help the Palestinians. And every time, would you please say every time? Every. Would you say it one more time? Every time the Palestinian leadership scuttled it. Mostly in the form of Yasser Arafat. Taba Summit was also scuttled by Arafat. The roadmap to peace, and there is now Mahmoud Abbas. He's the guy on the left. Arafat is dead. He died in 2004. And that is Ariel Sharon. And the agreement over movement and access after 2005, there's Mahmoud Abbas. He is now the president of the Palestinian Authority, also known as a Fatah. And they are in the West Bank, that is Nablus, and there is then Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. And then the Mitchell-led talks, there's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and then you see Mahmoud Abbas at the bottom, and then there's Netanyahu at the top, 2001, scuttled by the Palestinians. I just illustrated 12 times that the whole world was trying like crazy to give the Palestinians a two-state solution. Every time, would you please say it one more time? How many times? Every time it was scuttled by Palestinian leadership. Mostly this guy. Who's that? That's Yasser Arafat. He's the chairman of the PLO from 1969 to 2004. They are the most successful terrorist organization ever documented. They have killed more people combined, probably until the 3,000 plus were killed in our own 2001. He fought alongside the Muslim Brotherhood at the 1948 war that I told you about, and then he founded the Fatah Party, which is the Palestinians, and he died in the year 2004. This is Ahmad Yassin. He is the founder of Hamas. In 2004, Ariel Sharon, Prime Minister of Israel, is under tremendous pressure. Get out of Gaza, get out of Gaza, get out of Gaza. He said, we do, they're going to start lobbing bombs at us. No, they won't. He promised they wouldn't. They disengage in 2005. Ariel Sharon succumbs to a devastating stroke. And now what happens in Gaza, within months, you have an election of the Hamas party. Here is the Hamas charter. Hamas's founding charter in 1988. Preamble quoting a founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. We do not have time to develop who they were. You remember those Ottoman Turks I told you about that got kicked out? Guess where the core, the college, the central college landed? They landed in the Muslim Brotherhood. And they're pretty upset about their land that they believe is their land, not their land. They're pretty upset about that. Well, the preamble quote was by a founder, one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna. And he said, quote, Israel will exist and continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it has obliterated others before it. In Article 7 of this charter, the hour of judgment shall not come until the Muslim fight the Jews and kill them, so that the Jews hide behind trees and stones, and each tree and stone will say, O Muslim, O servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me. Come and kill him. It's in the charter. Article 15. I will assault and kill, comma, assault and kill, comma, assault and kill. You think they're trying to emphasize a theme. That is who Hamas is. When Israel disengaged from Gaza in the year 2005, Hamas was elected, and there's not been an election since. And since May 14th, 1948, Israel's neighbors have launched 16 wars against the nation the size of New Jersey, and of course, innumerable individual terrorist attacks. By the way, the word Hamas itself is an acronym. I can't pronounce the Arabic, but it comes from five words, and the acronym is Hamas. Is Hamas a word in the Bible? Turns out it is, actually. Look at this. You might find this interesting. It's in Genesis 6:11. The earth also was corrupt before man, and the earth was filled with violence. That's the word for violence in Hebrew, is Hamas. In Psalm 7, verses 14 through 16, behold, the wicked bring forth iniquity. Yes, he conceives trouble and brings forth falsehood. He made a pit and has fallen into a ditch that he made. His trouble shall return upon his own head, and his Hamas, his violent dealing, shall come down on his own head. I am not condoning warfare in any form of its iteration. War is awful. War is demonic. War is what the enemy uses to kill as many humans as he can. God reports on things in the Bible. It doesn't necessarily condone them either. But the Bible reports a very important fact, that when a violent man digs a ditch, he falls into that ditch very often, and his own violence comes back to him. Is at least a portion of that understanding potentially happening in Gaza? From the river to the sea, from the river to the sea, from the river to the sea, do you see a theme here? What does Hamas and Palestine, what do they mean by river to the sea? From the Jordan to the Mediterranean, eradicate all of the Jews. I don't know that that's what those people know about. All among the other signs, there are signs like this. The final solution. Some of you from this period of time after World War II sends a shiver down your back. Do you remember the term final solution? Who coined that phrase? Hitler did, and Himmler did. That's somebody walking in and amongst the students by the look of his gray hair picking out from under his cap. I don't believe he's a student. And very likely, most, if not many, of the people in these student protests are not students of that university. Isaiah 5 verse 20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. There was an Israeli president who once said, if Israel's enemies were to put down their weapons, there would be no war. If Israel were to put down her weapons, there would be no Jews. Does that make sense? That is on the mind of this gentleman strolling through the crowd. This is what he has in mind. By the way, on October 7th, over 1,200 human beings were hunted down, burned, tortured. It's not easy reading, but you need to know what happened to many of these people. Especially many of the women. I will not mention some of the specifics in polite company. You need to hear this heavy-hearted pastor say, it was absolutely demonic. It wasn't just sexual assault. It was sexual torture. And as you know, some babies were burned to death in their cribs. That happened October 7th. Almost more than 200 people were taken hostage. Was that a horrific day, you guys? Was it a horrific day? I don't care what side you're on. Were humans horrifically treated? When that day was announced, this is the celebration in the West Bank. This is Nablus on October 7th. And this is Gaza, October 7th. This is what they thought about it. That's Harvard. By any means, like October 7th, I don't believe that that's what these particular people, maybe they do. But do you understand and do we understand who we're dealing with when we're talking about the leadership of the Palestinians? At these state universities, students and professors call violations of pronouns, they and them, if you know what I'm talking about, a hostile act. Yet champion Hamas, who raped and tortured mutilated babies? I'm quoting to you now, this is from a Jewish rabbi and a historian of the Middle East. He says, wokeism rails against white colonialism and apartheidism. Today, there's not a lot of white colonialism around, so what do proponents of wokeism focus on? Israel! If any nation has been the victim of colonial powers and empires for the longest of times, it's the Jewish people. What do you think of that thought? The Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, do your history, look it up. The Greeks, the Romans, who killed a million Jews in 70 AD. The Byzantines, the Ottomans, the Spanish, the Russians, and of course the Nazi empires. These protesters, most are not students of those universities, are yelling that they are, quote, for the victim. When in fact, by chanting from the river to the sea, they are calling for the annihilation of the Jews, the most victimized people who have ever lived. Are you seeing the illogical notion of 2,400 universities all over the world chanting against Israel? Why is that? It's because of spiritual blindness, Harvest. That's why. August 2005, Israel did capitulate to world pressure and pulled out of Gaza. Within months, Hamas was elected to govern its 2 million people. There's not been an election since. And because Gaza has no real agriculture, power generating capacity, or no infrastructure, the world poured billions into Gaza. Where'd the money go? Instead of building infrastructure industry, Hamas bought rockets and missiles and weapons, and they built miles and miles and miles of tunnels. Much of those tunnels are storing those weapons. They are designed specifically to be under mosques, schools, and hospitals. Why is that? Because the Israelis who have I should be careful, but in my opinion, a shred of civility. Did you know that the Jews, when they were going to go into Gaza, they knew they had to go get Hamas, and they knew about the tunnels? And did you know that they knew they were going to have to level portions of Gaza? Why? because that's where the Hamas people put their rocket launchers, or in schools and in apartment buildings. And most of their stores of weapons were under hospitals. Why? Because Hamas knew that Israel would retaliate, and they were counting on tens of thousands of their own civilians' deaths to get the world against Israel. And it's working. Since 2006, Hamas leaders got richer and richer, and the population poorer and poorer. And for the last 18 years, Gazan schools have taught their children to hate and kill Jews. Genocide of the Gazan people? Really? After 1,200 of its own citizens were slaughtered, and still 100, including Americans, are still in prison, Israel purposely now drops leaflets to warn civilians to flee areas they are going after Hamas. You know about that, right? What country ever did that? Ever? No one. It was Hamas that purposely targeted Jewish civilians without warning. When terrorists destroyed the Twin Towers and our 3,000 people, do you remember? America fought two wars. Estimated civilian casualties, over 150,000. Stopping Adolf Hitler's terror resulted in the death of 38 million civilian deaths. It's as if the police have to stop a serial killer, said one commentator, who is purposely hiding in a crowded house. Then in order to stop him, who will certainly slaughter more, innocent people, some civilians, get caught in the crossfire. At these universities, it's like the students are booing the police while hailing the serial killer as the hero. Go to Gaza, go to the West Bank, and see if they will honor your pronouns or your sexual orientations or your drag queen library readings. See what freedom Sharia law says about that. Do these protesters know that that's what they're advocating for? There's a word that many of these universities' protesters are forgetting: sophomore. Sophomore. It's from the Greek sophos, wise, and moros, where we're going to get a word moron. Fool. Fools who believe that they are wise. Romans 1, verse 22, professing themselves what? They became fools. I got to show you who this guy is. Who is this guy? This is Muhammad Amin al-Husseini. He was born in 1897 in the Ottoman-controlled area of Jerusalem. He maybe even heard about Mark Twain passing by a few years before. By the way, what's happening in Jerusalem about this time? Not much. He fought against the Allies in World War I. In 1921, the Grand Mufti, this guy, of Jerusalem, he was made. In 1939, he leads an Arab revolt that killed many British soldiers. The British issued a warrant for his arrest, so he flees to Germany. A full supporter of the Nazis' final solution. Do we know what the final solution is? Let me rephrase. Kill how many of the Jews? Okay. Do we know what Hitler meant by that? A full supporter of the Nazis' final solution, he pledges his support for the new government of this guy. Husseini gets a commitment from Hitler to have full Arab control of Jerusalem and to, quote, destroy the Jewish element within the Arab sphere. What do you suppose Hitler meant by destroying the Jewish element within the Arab sphere? Kill them all. Inferred, the Holocaust would be taken to the land of Israel itself. 1942, Husseini visits functioning concentration camps. Throughout the war, al-Husseini translates, then broadcasts Nazi propaganda. I'm not making this up. Check it out. Throughout the Arab world, and he worked with this guy, Heinrich Himmler, the overseer of the Holocaust, to organize Muslim SS groups to target Jews. He publicly exhorted the Muslim world to follow the example of Nazi doctrine by killing Jews. That happened, folks. Broadcasting from Berlin, he exhorted Muslims all over the world to kill Jews wherever you find them. After the war, about to be tried as a war criminal, he better get out of there. He barely escaped the Nuremberg trials. He was accused of directly being responsible for the death of 400,000 Jews. This guy. They never got a chance to get him into court. He escapes to Egypt. He's received in Cairo as a hero, resumes his leadership by joining the Muslim Brotherhood. Remember I told you about those guys that got kicked out of Ottoman Turks? Where did many of them land? Egypt. Through the Mufti, anti-Semitism of the Nazis merges with Arab nationalism and radical Islamic ideology. The Muslim Brotherhood expands this potent mixture throughout the whole Muslim world. And in Cairo, the Mufti, once a paid employee of Adolf Hitler, he meets a young student. This young student, an Arab teenager attending a secondary school in Cairo. He takes the student under his wings, personally and passionately disciples the young man. And that young man is Yasser Arafat. I'm going to slow down and take a breath because you need to see this. This man is largely regarded as the father of the Palestinian movement. Who are they? Those were the Arabs who would not say that Israel is their nation. And many of them were in refugee camps in Gaza and many in the West Bank. And he started the Palestinian Liberation Organization until he died in 2004. He fought alongside the Muslim Brotherhood against Israel in the 1948 war. He founded the Fatah Party, and he personally discipled by, go, please don't forget this, Muhammad al-Husseini. Husseini connects Arafat to former Nazi military experts to train him on how to wage terrorist attacks against the Jews, which he does so for the next 50 years. And some of that was how to hijack an airliner, which he did, to Uganda. From the river to the sea, now you know what this means to those Palestinian leaders. And our college campus people don't have the slightest idea. 3,500 years of mass executions, pogroms, death camps, and gas chambers has taught the Jewish people one critical truth: that there is no bargaining with people who have sworn to kill you, all of you. Please, please don't forget what happened on October 7th. Unprovoked, Palestinian Hamas soldiers hunted down 1,200 Jewish civilians to kill, torture, rape, and burn alive. And they still hold 100 hostages. Some of those are Americans. Israel must eradicate Hamas. Do we understand why? 2005 taught them all over again. Remember, get out of Gaza. And Ariel Sharon capitulated. 2005 taught them all over again. If they capitulate to world pressure, Hamas will do this again and again and again, because their charter says so. You got to learn, we have to learn, you have to believe people when they tell you who they are. Are these massive worldwide Palestinian protests fulfilling Bible prophecy? Are they? Do these people understand what they're doing when they say, America, stand up for Gaza? And they have no idea what went behind and why they're even Palestinians in Gaza and how they got there. And the 12 plus times all of those leaders of those Palestinians told the world to go stick their two-state solution in their ear. The world has tried. Is this fulfilling Bible prophecy? And here is the punchline. Zechariah 12, verses 2 and 3. In the last days, behold, says the Lord, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling to all the surrounding peoples. What little nation on the planet is in the news every single night? And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people, and all nations of the earth are gathered against it. Anti-Semitism is exploding across the whole planet Harvest. It's demonic. It's not political. It's demonic. It is always inspired by the demonic, and it's going to get much worse because these really are the last days. But I got one more verse for you. Are you ready? Now, when you see these things begin to happen, look up and lift your heads. I'm coming back. Let's all stand. Harvest, thank you for paying attention. Thank you, Lord Jesus, that you put upon this shepherd's heart, Lord, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. Now, the work of the ministry is often throwing an arm around someone and encouragement and prayer. But sometimes the work of the ministry is correction. And sometimes the work of the ministry is actually, you got to repent, you got to stop, you've got to relearn. And sometimes it's a rebuke. This is going to be on tape, probably not tonight. It's going to take us a while to cut it together, but hopefully tomorrow this whole thing is going to be on. Go over all of these facts. Would you please check me? Would you please do your research and see if I'm wrong? But if I am not wrong, do you see that the wide-eyed students, and many of them who are not students in these universities, calling Israel the genocide people? Do you see how ridiculous that is? And do you see that the entire planet has tried to help the Palestinians since 1947? And it is those leadership who have scuttled it every time. Why? Because it has not and never been about land for peace. Please understand this. Please understand this. Israel, back off, they say. And without this understanding, they will miss the most crucial part of the entire incident and the entire crux of the entire argument. It's not land for peace. It is Palestine calling for the death and eradication of the Jews. And they will not stop until that happens. Do we see that, Harvest? Israel has to stop Hamas. And if Rafah is the last place where the last of them are, they have to go there. And please notice how many nations of the world are shaking their finger at Israel and saying, you better not. All, including our own president, threatening to withhold aid if they do. And there is Zechariah chapter 12. Harvest, we are living in awesome times. Lord Jesus, by your grace, I pray, Father, that we see this as an opportunity to get educated. To open the door, Lord. It's going to be heated discussion. I know it will, but we can always bring it back to this. The Bible knew that all of this was coming. All of it. Even Gaza. It knows. And if the Bible was right about Israel becoming a nation again in one day, and the Gaza-Hamas conflict, it knows about you. And please, please, would you give him your whole life? God zipped up a human suit and got on a cross and paid for all sin for you. What's your excuse? Can you recognize the season? Are you going to be the men of Issachar that knew what season they were in and then they made the right choices? In Jesus' name, and now all of us say, amen. 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 If you'd like some prayer, come to the front. We'd love to pray with you. We'll see you on Tuesday prayer, everybody.